Welcome to the fourth lecture. So we discussed differential geometry. We discussed some topics in the Lagrangian mechanics. And so today I would like to do a review of Hamiltonian mechanics. Are there any questions to Lagrangian mechanics? Okay. So Hamilton's canonical equations formulated 1834. Hamilton was 29 years old then. So let me do it very quickly. So the first step, if you want to go from Lagrangian mechanics to Hamiltonian mechanics, is to introduce a canonical momentum. And that's defined as you take the Lagrangian, you differentiate it with respect to your generalized coordinate time derivative of that, and then you define this to be a new quantity which you call generalized momentum. So now what you can do is that the Lagrangian mechanics works on a configuration space, whereas the Hamiltonian mechanics works on a phase space. So what is the difference? So configuration space as a phase space. Well, I am now lying to you. If you have read the last section of the notes, you also know that the Lagrangian mechanics can work on the phase space, which is, however, a velocity phase space. But let me not go into that. So configuration space, what I mean by that is basically like a photo of the system at a given time. So to describe everything, all I need is just the coordinates, and the dimension of this configuration space is just n if I have n degrees of freedom in my system. So that's what a configuration space is. So now phase space is extended. It includes this generalized momenta as well. So this really describes, of course, if I take a photo of the system, if I only know where all the particles are, I don't have the complete information about that thing. And then we partly discussed that yesterday. So you need also the velocities to say what the state really is. So this is just a photo, but if I want everything, so describes physical states, then I need to extend this by adding these momenta as well. And dimension is now, of course, twice as much, 2n. And so Hamiltonian mechanics likes phase-phase. So now another crucial concept is that of the Hamiltonian. And in our case, although of course it's not generally true, it will be just a Legendre transform. Lagrangian, so why I say it's not generally the case is because this Legendre transform may not exist. And so there are some degenerate cases, especially if you have gauge symmetries in your system and so on, where actually one formulation, let's say Hamiltonian formulation, is okay, but you cannot really go straightforward to the Lagrangian formulation or vice versa. So But for mechanical systems, if you are clever enough, you can always do it. And so then you define Hamiltonian, which is now a function of generalized coordinates, momenta, and it's just the Legendre transformation. So it's pi qi dot minus your Lagrangian. Of course, Lagrangian is a function of Q and Q dot, and I see Q dot here, but I don't see it here. So I have to eliminate Q dot in terms of P and Q. So in the end, what you have to do, you have to write QI dot in terms of Q JN, PJ and T, and that is done through the defining relation of P. So right-hand side of that defining relation is the function of Q and Q dot, left-hand side is function of P, and so if you invert that, so you write Q dot as a function of Q and P from that relation, then you just plug it here and that's it. So I write Q dot I as a function of QJ, PJ, and T. Okay? And so it's precisely inverting this relation which may cause troubles. So that's something which may not exist, or you may not be able to do that. And we'll discuss that a little bit later, but not much in detail.
Is there a reason you're calling this Hamiltonian than yesterday? Very
likely. Yeah, so it looks similar, right? Yeah, so true. So this thing will be something like a generalized energy if it will be conserved quantity. Yeah, that's right. Yeah. So now theorem due to Hamilton. So the system of n Euler Lagrange equations, if we have n degrees of freedom, is equivalent to two n. Now, so you know that. Well, I just briefly mentioned that the Euler Lagrange equations typically are second order differential equations. So now, what we will be doing, we will be trading n of them, or n second order equations, to 2n first order equations. So first order Hamilton equations and these are written as Pj dot is dh over dqj, and the second equation is qj dot is dh over dpj, and now I forgot the minus sign, which is over here. So always one of these equations has a minus sign, I never know which one, so it's this one here. Equal to, and then it's a minus sign, dh over dqj, and the other one is like that. So that's a theorem. So to prove it, of course, what you can do is that you can, for example, start with the definition of the Hamiltonian. So I take this definition, and let's say I differentiate it with respect to pj, and then I have to use Euler Lagrange equations. And if you do that, you get that it's equal to qj dot, and similarly with the other equation. Or you can use, and let me do it because it's, well, let's do it, it's nice. So proof from the, again, the action principle, from that's Revoke Hamilton's action principle of least action, so variational principle. And basically, the calculation goes exactly the same as when you were deriving the Euler Lagrange equations, but now you treat Q and P as independent. Okay, so you have 0 equals to delta S, my action. So now action is, of course, an integral L dt, but I can write L as PQ dot minus H. It's an integral, well, it's delta of an integral 1 to 2, and then p I q I dot minus L minus h and dt. I don't know why. Okay. So now let's vary this. So I have an integral 1 to 2, and so I have delta PI QI dot. Then I have to differentiate QI. But again, so there's a delta of derivative, time derivative of QI. I can swap the two. So it's plus PI d over dt delta QI. And then the Hamiltonian is a function of QI and PI. And again, I don't care if it's a function of time or not, because I'm doing delta, which doesn't, the variation, which doesn't care about time at all. Okay, so this is what it is. So now all you have to do is just to collect the right terms and integrate by parts. So this is equal to, so now when I integrate by parts this term, I pick up a boundary term, so pi delta QI from 1 to 2. And then plus the integral. And so let's collect, let's put a big bracket here. Let's collect delta PI. So then from this term, I have QI dot. And then another delta PI is over here. So it's minus dH over dPI, and then I have a term plus, or let's say minus, delta QI, and then from here I have dH over dQI, and I have no space, but if I did, so if I integrated this guy by parts, I'm just shifting the derivative, time derivative onto this guy, and I'm picking up a minus sign, so it's plus pi dot. And the whole thing is still dt. And now you obviously see, so what's happening. So now again, I impose fixed endpoints. So this guy is equal to 0. I treat the variation of p and the variation of q as arbitrary and independent. And so that means that this guy has to be 0 separately, and that guy has to be 0 separately. And that gives you the Hamilton's equation. Okay, questions? Everything is so simple and nice, right? Yeah?
You don't need to use the definition of the canonical momentum at all?
Well, you are sort of using it implicitly by saying that H is already a function of Q and P, and that you are treating them as independent in some sense, yes. I have already done the Legendre transformation to this thing. Yeah. I already have H as a function of Q and P. Yeah. So, yeah. So that's the proof. So by the way, what do you think? So there was this question already, why is there any connection of this Hamiltonian and the generalized energy? And so the question is, what is dH over dt? So any suggestions? It will be 0. So let's show that. So it's dH over dq, q dot, plus dH over dp, p dot, plus dH over dt. Okay, so now I have, if there's an explicit dependence of H on time, which can be, I have these things. But now you want to impose the canonical equation. So you know that dH over dq is minus p dot. And dH over dp is q dot. So the first two terms actually eat each other. And then you have that this is equal to dH over dt. So as long as h is not explicit function of t, then h is an integral of motion, is conserved. Which is precisely the same condition as we had last time, right? When Lagrangian wasn't explicitly a function of time, then we could find this generalized energy. Of course, this generalized energy is exactly the Hamiltonian which we are talking about here. Okay, well, this is all very nice. So let me just make an intermezzo. I don't know if you've seen this word. It's like, let's pause, let's do something else, and then let's continue the story. So here, this is all about Legendre transformation, so going basically from Q dot to P. So I don't want to discuss any properties of Legendre transformation from a mathematical point of view, because, yeah, physicists, we don't care. But it's definitely worth mentioning that Legendre transformation actually, you know, is a central object in physics, and not only in classical mechanics, but basically everywhere. So let me just mention something which you already know, but I want to stress that. So Legendre transformation in thermodynamics. Transformation in thermodynamics. And I don't want to bore you, so I'll just plot a magic square, which contains all of thermodynamics. And I guess you have seen that square already somewhere. But if not, I think it's very nice. So you have a magic square, and it is a square. And then you put all the interesting quantities in the corners of that square. So you have the internal energy, you have the free energy, you have the enthalpy, the Gibbs free energy, and you have the enthalpy. So which are the central thermodynamic potentials which appear in thermodynamics, and we will need this in statistical physics course, so that's why I'm reviewing this. And then you have quantities like volume, temperature, pressure, and entropy. So this is all very nice. Still wouldn't be magic unless there were some pluses and minuses. So let's say there is a plus here, minus here, and minus here. So let me borrow an analogy from electrostatics. So you know that the field strength goes from plus to minus. So we have these things like that. And that's the magic square. And this magic square contains all of thermodynamics, basically. So what information are stored in this magic square? So you know that the thermodynamic potentials, meaning internal energy, free energy, and so on, behave nicely if they are functions of their own variables. Okay? So in particular, R total differentials of their, if they are expressed in terms of their variables. In their variables, so that means you always look at, you know, the variables which are on the same line as your potential is, and then this is the right thing. Okay, so for example, the internal energy will be a total differential if it's expressed in terms of the entropy and the volume. And then the question only is about the sign of the corresponding thing, and you just read the sign about plus or minus, which is next to it. So then you know that du is definitely plus Tds because of this plus, and then minus Pdv. Okay. So similarly, you can just write, let's say, dh. So then it will be Tds plus Vdp. Okay, so that's how to remember these things. So it's always the signs.
Can you clarify what you mean by potentials or total differentials in their own variable?
Yeah, so you know, if... Huh?
I mean, you said they're nice if they're expressed. I don't know, that just sounds tautological. So they're nice if they're expressed in their own variable. Something like that.
Well, okay, so for example, if you write it in terms of something else, well, the expression is not so nice, right? Okay. So if you discuss, for example, you know, you're interested in equilibrium in thermodynamics usually. And so you know that the equilibrium corresponds to, let's say, minimum or maximum of things. So for example, I want to find the minimum of the internal energy, and you know that it will happen when ds and dv is equal to zero. So if I, you know, if I keep these things, then it's, if I keep s and v constant, I know that the quantity which will be minimized is the internal energy. I'll discuss this a little bit more in statistical physics course. This is just, you know, to remember what the correct relations are for which thermodynamic potentials. So as the first thing which you can learn from this magic square, second thing you can learn from this magic square, how exactly that one thermodynamic potential is related to the other one. And so, for example, if I want to find what a free energy is, how the Legendre transform goes from internal energy to the free energy, then you know that V is the same, so I don't have to do anything here, but I have to change the entropy to the temperature. And then the question is which sign you are using, and it's precisely again the sign which is over here. So in other words, the free energy is just given U minus TS. I'm always changing this guy to that guy, and this is the sign I need to use. If I wanted an enthalpy, I have to, if I wanted an enthalpy, I see a plus sign, I have to change V to P, so it'll be U plus PV, and so on. Okay? Of course, you are still doing the Legendre transformation, which means in the first case, I am changing S to T, so you need to provide something like this generalized momentum. So you need to say what T is, and you see that T is just du over ds from this relation. So then this is complete Legendre transformation, which you need to do. And you have to invert again, something like changing Q dot to P and so on. Okay, so that's the second information the magic square has. Third information is the fence information, something which is called Maxwell relations. And so basically always you look at the quantities here and there, and the opposite side quantities there and there. So for example, you have that dV over dS at constant P. So this over that constant P is this over that at constant that. Okay, so it's equal to dT over dP at constant S. So what you are doing is you are always looking at this, and you are looking at the opposite thing, and this is the thing which is constant, and you are putting this quantity over that quantity. Okay, you can do it other way around. You can have dS over dP at constant V is dV over dT at constant P. And again, there is this magic sign, and you read that sign. So there's a sign here, and that tells you what sign it is. Okay, so these are called Maxwell relations. You can also read them from this magic square. How will you prove this? Is, well, you have to write the corresponding differential for the corresponding potential. So in this case, actually, so to prove this Maxwell relation, I have to write for the enthalpy, you know that the enthalpy is plus plus, so T ds plus VdP, that's my enthalpy. In other words, it means that T is dH over dS, and V is dH over dP. And now you differentiate once more and swap the derivatives. So if I do here d over dP, and I do here d over dS, then the derivatives have to swap. if H is smooth, and then you have dt over dp is dv over ds, which is precisely this thing here. Okay, so they, so I just wanted to show you, you know, Legendre transformation is everywhere, especially in thermodynamics. You have this nice square, and this is very nice thing to, you know, to use if you, you can find it in Wikipedia as well, but to remember these relations, I think it's quite nice. Questions? No questions. Okay, so let me return back to classical mechanics. And let me discuss concept everybody is familiar with, is the Poisson brackets. So you define a Poisson bracket. So let F and G be two be phase space functions, then they're canonical Poisson bracket is a new function on phase space and it's defined by F and G is DF over DQI DG over the PI, so there's a sum, and then minus the other way around, DF over the PI, DG over the QI. Okay. So basically, given two functions, I can find another function on the phase space, and it's given here. So now, who hasn't seen Poisson brackets? Very good. So what are their properties? So first of all, there's something which is called fundamental brackets, which is, you know, if I take F and G to be Q and P. So that's something which is, so it's all called fundamental brackets. So let's put one fundamental brackets and then so what is QI PJ? Delta IJ, thank you. And then if you have two P's, PI PJ, then it's equal to zero. And what happens with Q's? It's also equal to zero. Okay, you can immediately get this if you plug, you know, P and Q into this definition. You will find that this is true. So now, fundamental brackets, of course, play a very important role if you want to quantize your theory. So that's basically the standard quantization procedure goes that you say, well, I promote my Q and P to operators. And then I replace the Poisson brackets with the commutator of these operators. And so this thing then becomes, so if you go to quantum mechanics, this becomes QI hat PJ hat is, and now you say, well, is this fundamental constant IH bar delta IJ? And so this is all of quantum mechanics, right? Of course, this procedure is not unique if you have some complicated functions of Q and P because you don't know, well, what is the right ordering and so on. The other way around is the fundamental way. If you know the quantum mechanical thing, then you can go to a classical limit. Going from classical to quantum is always guessing. right? The fundamental theory is the quantum theory. Okay, so that's the first property. Second property is, of course, these things are anti-symmetric because of this minus sign here. Anti-symmetry. In other words, f and g is minus g and f. They are linear. Meaning, if I have alpha times f plus beta times g acting on h, it's just alpha fh plus beta gh. Okay, so this is true if alpha and beta are real, just numbers. And you have Leibniz rule. Okay, so fg acting on h is just fgh plus fh and g. Okay, so that's the fourth property which you can infer from the definition. And finally, you can play with that. There is something which is called Jacobi identity. And so you go cyclically around all the Poisson brackets, and you have three of them. So you have f, g, and h. So you may be crazy and calculate such a quantity here. And then you may add this to another quantity where I go cyclically around. So I'll move h, and then everything shifts to the back. So I'll have h, f, and g. And once more, so I'll have g, h, and f, and you find the recursive that this is equal to 0. Okay, so let's call Jacobi identity. Basically, all the properties which follow from this definition. So, as a funny part, remarks. So, the first remark will be that. Yes, you can start with the definition as I did. So I'm giving you explicit formula how to calculate a Poisson bracket. But actually, more generally, you can start with these properties 1 to 5 and call that a Poisson bracket. And then use it as a definition. And in some sense, this should already follow from there. So can use 1 to 5 as definition. What 1 to 5 also means is that actually the Poisson brackets form Lie algebra. So again, ask Gong in the Lie algebra course what that means. So now this is not a stupid remark as it seems. Actually, people like Feynman a long time ago, we're looking, okay, so can we get something more general than classical mechanics or electromagnetism by playing with Poisson brackets? And so he was looking at the structure of the Poisson brackets, and he said, well, let's not use some of these fundamental properties. Let's relax some of the conditions on Poisson brackets. Can I get some more interesting theory? And he was very disappointed he couldn't. So you will do this on Tuesday in your tutorial. So really relaxing some of these conditions, you know, question is, do we get some interesting theory out of this? And it will be disappointing. You get, all you get is an electromagnetism. Okay, nothing else is there. Okay, so it was first remark. So second remark is that now in terms of the Poisson bracket, you can write time evolution very neatly. So So if I have any function on the phase space, I can write its time evolution. Well, it's df over dq, q dot, plus df over dp, p dot, and so on. But if you use the Hamilton's equations, what q dot and p dot are, then it's just the Poisson bracket f with the Hamiltonian. Unfortunately, if there is an explicit time dependence, you have also that term. But it's usually not there, so then you have this beautiful relation that df over dt is just Poisson bracket of f with your Hamiltonian. Everybody sees that, right? If you don't, just write one line proof. Okay? So that's second remark. Third remark is, so I define in Lagrangian mechanics, I define what I mean by an integral of motion, which is something which doesn't change, evolve in time. So now from here, you see that integral of motion, so I require that df over dt equals to zero. Of course, integral of motion cannot explicitly depend on time, because if it did, it couldn't be an integral of motion. So then this has to be zero, right? So integral of motion is simply defined by I h equals to zero in terms of the Poisson bracket. Okay. Yes?
Did you say that an integral of motion can't depend explicitly on time?
Yeah.
But I thought when you apply Noether's theorem to get to a system where the Lagrangian depended explicitly on time, the resulting integral of motion had an explicit time dependency.
No, the statement was if the Lagrangian does not depend explicitly on time, this is the generalized energy.
I see.
Sorry if I confused that. But yeah, if something depends explicitly on time, it probably is not conserved in time, right? If it's different.
It can just be canceled out by Q.
Well, in principle, yes, it could be, but I've never seen anything like that. Maybe you can have some pathological fine-tuned case where this is the case, but yeah. Yeah. Well, mathematically, yes, you can have that. But I don't think you can have that for a physical system. Okay, so now what is also very nice is that if you happen to have two integrals of motion and take their Poisson bracket, you actually integrate, you generate another integral of motion. So it seems as a very, very good property, more than you can wish for, right? So provided you are lucky and you find two integrals of motion, then it seems that you can generate many more integrals of motion. Of course, in practice, what happens is that this procedure usually terminates very quickly. So this is a new integral of motion. But in practice, what happens is that it usually actually trivial and it's equal to zero. So for systems, you can generate some integrals of motion, but usually not so many. And so you will prove this statement in tutorial on Tuesday. But it's very simple to prove. Okay, so this is, well, it is very nice. So the Poisson brackets are very beautiful concept. Questions to Poisson brackets? Okay, part C, canonical transformations. So Hamiltonian mechanics is very, very powerful. and it's beautiful as well. And so one of the reasons, if nothing else, is these Poisson brackets are really, really beautiful, right? But really, the strength of the Hamiltonian mechanics relies on the fact that there is a huge freedom in Hamiltonian mechanics. And all this is encoded in these canonical transformations. So let me tell you what a canonical transformation is. So we have a definition. You can change coordinates, basically. A canonical transformation. So you can go from old Q and P, which I will denote by small letters, to capital letters Q and P. So you can have a new Q, which is a function of the old Q and old P and time. And you can find a new P as well, so far this is just any transformation of coordinates, if you want any transformation of generalized momenta and coordinates. But in order this transformation to be canonical, you require that this transformation preserves preserves the form of Hamilton's equations. So what I mean by that is that there exists, so what it means is that there exists, is a question? No? A new Hamiltonian H prime, which is now a function of my new coordinates, Qj, and then Pj and T, such that I have exactly the same form of Hamilton's equations as over there, which means that Pj dot is dH prime over, again, minus sign dQj, and Qj dot is dH prime over dPj. Okay, so that's the definition, what you mean by a canonical transformation. Of course, you can start with a different definition, but I like this one. Okay, so it's not, so you may think now, okay, so how much restrictive is this, right? So first of all, I don't even require that the Hamiltonian is the same Hamiltonian as before. So the only thing you require is that there exists such a function H prime, so that this actually is equivalent to that. Okay, so it seems, yes?
Aren't you going from one system to a completely different system? The same number of degrees of freedom, and that's the only thing they have in common?
Well, you sort of require, well, what is in this definition is that I'm saying that those equations over there are sort of equivalent to those equations over there. Okay, so it's not a different system.
Take any system that has, any system has a Hamiltonian, has Qs, and has E's.
Okay.
For which those equations are satisfied. That's just.
But they are not equivalent. No, so what I require here is that they are equivalent in some sense. You will see that. Let me work on this.
You already wrote down the definition.
Yeah.
You're going to add something to the definition.
No. No, I'm just going to explain what I mean by the definition, if you want.
With that definition, you can go from any system to any system.
No, I don't think so. Exists a new Hamiltonian H prime such that this is true.
For any Hamiltonian system, there exists.
And you know, so what I'm saying here is that this is equivalent to those equations. So I didn't write it, but what I'm saying is that this is equivalent to those equations.
What?
Right? What? That these equations are equivalent to those equations.
You need to require that you still have the same ground given.
No.
No.
No. Okay. So Note that not every transformation is canonical. So why don't I continue and canonical? And maybe, you know, if at the end you are still unhappy, so maybe we can work on this definition more. Okay? So
you are requiring some kind of equivalence between these two sets of equations.
But you know, all I'm doing is that I'm doing a coordinate transformation here, right? So this is some concrete coordinate transformation.
Any coordinate transformation.
Yeah.
When you look at the induced maps on the function, is it has to preserve the plus on strict
Yeah. That's right. Yeah. Okay. So now this is a true statement. Not every transformation is canonical. Now I'll give you an example of this, which, however, doesn't prove anything, and you shouldn't believe me on this example. It's just basically to motivate that it may be true that not every canonical transformation is canonical, but it's really not foolproof example. So, you know, so let's say I have a free particle, and of course this example has many loose ends. So really, you know, take it with caution. So. This is described by Hamiltonian, which is p square over 2m. And let's consider a transformation where I take large q to be square root of q and large p to be small p. Okay? So if I do this, then of course I'm saying, well, you should be seeking for a new h prime. And I will not just do this, I will just guess at this point. And you can prove it later that this should be really the candidate. But anyway, h prime is my p square over 2m. Well, it looks possible because p is p. But so this is just a guess. I'm not saying that if you try something else at this point, some other h prime, that it will not work. But let's just go with this guess. So then I have dh prime over dp. Well, it's just p over m, which is small p over m, which is dh original over dp. And by the original equation, this must be equal to q dot. Okay, but my old q is q square. So this is equal to 2q q dot. But if this were true, then it must be equal to q dot from that equation here, which obviously is not. So actually, this is an example of a transformation which is not canonical. Okay. Of course, as I said, I haven't proved that if you choose another h prime, it will still not work. But this transformation is not canonical. It's the statement which is correct statement. So then, of course, the question is, you know, how to find canonical transformations. So if this one, if not every transformation is canonical, then, you know, how do I get which transformations are canonical, or how to generate nice canonical transformations? And so canonical transformations are or can be generated tautologically by generating functions. So a generating function is simply a function, let's call it f, and it always has a structure that you put one old coordinate and one new coordinate. Okay, it's a function, if you want, of two variables, where one of them is the old one, and so old is small q and p, and new is big q and p. So now you obviously see that I can choose, let's say, old small q and a new big q. That's one possibility, but I can have also others, so I have four possibilities. Four possibilities.
It's always a function of two of those.
So it always has to be a function of one old. For each old, there is a new. Yeah. Yeah. If you have more QIs, and yeah, and then there's more, of course. Okay. And so you have four possibilities, and you may think, well, this is highly non-unique and whatsoever. But the secret is that no matter which possibility you choose, if the system is generic, then the generating functions are actually connected by Legendre transformation. So again, Legendre transformation enters into these things. And there is no such big non-uniqueness of these things as it may seem. So let's do an example. So for example, you can choose f to be, as I said, function of small q, big q, and t. Okay, so t again is there. If you don't like it, forget about t. So the question is, if I do this, what happens with my action? So you have your action. And okay, so the original action is just p q dot minus h. That was my original action. But what I showed you in Lagrangian mechanics at the very beginning is that actually, this is again the Lagrangian, so this is Lagrangian, and Lagrangian is not unique. I can add a total derivative to a Lagrangian, and it still gives me the same equations of motion. So now let's use this freedom, and let's put simply the total derivative of this generating function. Okay, so this is the freedom I have in Lagrangian mechanics. I just decided to subtract. Sorry, if you are used to edit. Okay, so now what is this equal to? So I just write, so now f is a function of small q and big q. So I just have to do df over dq, q dot, and df over the a capital Q, q, q dot. Okay, so then what I can do is I can actually connect whatever the q dot are the same. So this is equal to, so I'll have q dot, and there's this p. And then I have minus df over dq. Okay, and then I have minus df over the q, q dot. And finally, I have minus h, and then plus df over dt, if that explicitly depends on time. OK, so this is what it is. You're just differentiating your generating function. And then if this is what I want by my definition, my action must be possible to write my action in terms of this new coordinate, p, big P and big Q, so that it has the standard form, this form. So what you require is that this is equal to p q dot minus h prime dt. So if this is true, then the Hamilton's equations will be the same. So this is what you require. Because then it's, you know, so this thing will have exactly those equations of motion in terms of small p's, and that thing will have those equations of motion in terms of big p's. So this is what you require. Okay, so this is what we want. So how to do that? So you see that I'll have exactly the same form if this thing is P. So if this thing is P, I'll have PQ dot there. If this thing is my new H prime, I'll have this thing. And if this thing is equal to zero, I'll satisfy what I want. Okay, so in other words, you want that the small p is df over dq. You require that big P is minus df over dq. And finally, if h prime is h plus df over dt. And so what these equations tell you that if, you know, given f, so you can specify any f you want, just function of small q and big q and t, and these equations give what is q, p, and h prime in terms of the old ones. Okay, so this is how you get canonical transformations. Exactly, yeah, thank you for that. So it is not so simple. There is also integrability conditions. Yeah, so, yeah, thank you. So there is also integrability condition. So in other words, you must have that d square of f is dq dq. So what is this? So it's d over dq of p. And it must be the same thing as if you swap the derivatives. So I'll just write it down. Minus dp dq, which is d square of f dq dq. So in some sense, this is an integrability condition so that, this can be done. Okay. But in some sense, yeah, so this tells you how to generate the canonical transformations. If you don't like f to be function of small q and big q, you can choose anything else. You will get different prescription here. But as I said, so the choices are basically connected by Legendre transformation for generic systems, unless the Legendre transformation doesn't exist again. Okay, so. Some remarks. I'll have three remarks, maybe four remarks, regarding these canonical transformations. And I'll offer you some kind of proof, which is a physical proof. And mathematicians don't like it, and even physicists probably don't like it. But it's the proofs used in Landau and Lischitz. And so they are very intuitive, but probably not correct. Okay, but anyway. So first remark is that Poisson brackets are invariant. And somebody already had mentioned that with respect to the canonical transformation, So what I mean by that is that if you write a Poisson bracket in terms of small q and p, that of course is the same Poisson bracket if I write it in terms of big q and p. Okay, so this is one statement. So I can change these coordinates, and it gives me the same thing. So how to physically see this? So we have this beautiful equation here. So let's forget about df over dt. And so what I'm saying is that the time evolution of a function is given by the Poisson bracket of that function with the Hamiltonian. Okay, so let's think about that. Actually, so proof, which is given in Landau and Lefschetz, is beautiful proof. So let's think about G as the Hamiltonian. Okay, so if you think about G as the Hamiltonian, then actually this is something like df over dt is f of G. Right, so. This will be given precise meaning next week, but yeah. So let's just think about G as a Hamiltonian. So this is some kind of time evolution of my f. And now it's of course obvious that the time evolution of a physical function cannot depend on which coordinates I use, right? So no matter which coordinates I use, the motion is unique. And so it must be the same no matter which coordinates I use. So independent of coordinates.
But how would you prove that using G equal to a Hamiltonian?
No, I'm just saying, you can think about G as the Hamiltonian.
But not every G may be a Hamiltonian.
You will see next week precisely what this means.
Okay.
Yeah. but yeah, very intuitively you can think about it. Why not? Yeah. So yeah, it'll be some Hamiltonian for some system. No matter what phase space function I have, it can be some Hamiltonian, right? For some system.
But the Hamiltonian for Q, letter Q, is not
the little Hamiltonian.
I mean, the Hamiltonian
That was clever. I deleted this df over dt. So actually, if there is no explicit time dependence, they are the same. So if you look here, so if I don't put the explicit time dependence here, then the Hamiltonians actually are the same. So yeah, I was clever to evade that possibility. Okay, so anyway, so that's the proof in Landau and Lefschetz. Remark number two. Here, two. So since Q and P are new canonical coordinates, so this is just to state something that everybody knows, are new canonical coordinates, because Hamilton equations have exactly the same form. So that means that the Poisson bracket of these things must be those fundamental Poisson brackets, delta ij, and so on. So 0 for q and q, and for p and p. So this must be true. So now, if you write these in terms of small q and p, so this is obvious if you write them in terms of big q and p. So that's by definition, it's just. Yeah, but if you write it in terms of small q and p, then this is an integrability condition for your transformation to be canonical, which is precisely that one over there. Integrability condition for the transformation to be canonical. So let's say I really check, I postulate my new capital Q and capital P, and so to find that whether the transformation is canonical or not, in terms of the small q and p, is really I check, are the Poisson brackets the fundamental Poisson brackets or not? If they are, I was lucky and I found canonical transformation. Okay. Transformation is canonical. Okay. So now the most interesting part, I would say, about canonical transformations is that you maybe thinking about time evolution. Well, I was trying to tell you that the time evolution is something real over there, but actually time evolution is just a canonical transformation. It's just a change of coordinates, okay? So time evolution is actually a change of coordinates. Or a little bit more precisely, it is a canonical transformation. Transformation generated by a generating function. Can anybody guess what this generating function is? Almost correct. Some other guesses? Some other guesses? It's a very good guess, but almost. Huh? Uh-huh. It's another guess. So it's actually, you cannot know that. I'm just teasing you. Because I haven't mentioned this function here yet, although I mentioned it in a different context. I mentioned it as a functional. It's actually generated by the action. Okay. So it's generated by f, which is minus s. So now this may seem very, very strange, right? So you know that the action is a functional, it's not a function. So how the hell this can happen?
So generating function needs to be written in terms of an old and a new variable.
Yes.
You need to rewrite the action.
Yeah, exactly. Exactly. So yeah, precisely. So this is the statement. So now it seems very strange and very, very crazy. So to prove this, you have to think about action differently. And so the key idea, is to understand that actually action is not only a functional, is to understand S as a function, not a functional, of time and coordinates, So how is this done? So you know that S is just an integral. And now let me write it stupidly, but from t0 and q0 to t and q, so from 1 to 2, right? But you are fixing this, whatever the q is there, and whatever the q0 was there at t0 and final t of ldt. And so this, in some sense, is a functional of the trajectory, right? But let's assume that I have already found the trajectory. Okay, so I'm already on shell. I fixed the trajectory. Let's say it's a straight line. If I plug this trajectory into the Lagrangian here, and calculate this integral and evaluate it as a function of t and q of initial conditions and final conditions, I have a function of t and q and t0 and q0. Okay, so on shell, which means the trajectory is already fixed. Yes, fixed. Let's say it's a straight line. Then this is simply written as S, which is a function of Q0, T0, Q, and T. Right? Because I already plug in that X is VT or something like that. And so you just evaluate this as a function of the initial and final conditions. Have you ever done that? Who has done this? It's used in all the time in path integrals and in quantum gravity. Okay, so maybe we should do an exercise on this. Okay, so this is fine, and this is so far, again, it's an argument by Landau and Lefschetz. So this is okay. So now what is a little bit suspicious is this step here, and so don't blame me for this step. So if I have S as a function of these things, but at the same time I write it as an integral T0 Q0 TQ of L dt, but I write L as P dQ minus H, so then the statement is if you sort of differentiate this thing and use the fundamental theorem of analysis, then this is written as P dq, and let me put indices, so pi dqi minus h dt, and as I say, don't blame me for this, so at the final time, minus pi dqi minus h dt at the initial time. So I write it as a differential in this way, and it's not rigorous, but it's fine. It gives the right result, so it's fine. So, okay, so just a remark, from here, and using that this is really a total differential, let's say I forget about the initial thing, set these things equal to zero, or I don't care. So then you immediately read from here that ds over dqi is actually pi, and at the same time that ds over dt is minus h. Okay, so this is just a remark. This is nothing else than a Hamilton-Jacobi equation which we'll discuss next week. Okay, so this is Hamilton-Jacobi equation, which gives completely different perspective on Hamiltonian mechanics. But let me postpone discussion of this for the next week. So that was just a remark, but I'll use that expression now to show you that really the generating function is the action in terms of Q and Q0. And so the final step to actually prove this is to realize that if you find the solution, so the solution of your equation of motion is simply written as Q of t is a function of now my initial conditions, P0 and T, and T0, and the same for P. PT is P, Q0, P0, T, and T0. So this is the solution of your equations of motion if you actually find it, right? So now the statement is this is a canonical transformation generated by generating function which is equal to minus S. And so to show that, we again integrate this relation here. So then you have an integral of ds equals to an integral of pi, so let's put just p and q, so p dq minus h dt, and then minus an integral, and let's put p0 dq0 n h 0 dt. So I integrate this relation here. Or if you rewrite it, then integral of p dq minus h dt equals to, and let me put this guy on the right-hand side. So it's an integral p0 dq0 minus h0 dt, and then minus minus ds over dt. dt, and that's probably wrong. It's dt here. Okay, so this is what it is. So now you see these are my new coordinates, p and q, which actually is the solution to my equations of motion at any time t. And so these are my original coordinates, p0 and q0. And the original Hamiltonian. And this is just a total derivative which I'm adding to it. So it's just a thing which we use for generating functions. So this is my generating function df over dt. So s, f equal to minus s is the generating function for this transformation. So you may start thinking about time evolution in Hamiltonian mechanics just as the choice of the coordinates. Let me stop here.